This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what's next for crisis-stricken Venezuela? And why did President Donald Trump reverse former President Barack Obama's U.S.-Cuba policy? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Even as the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany, and the much-anticipated Trump-Putin meeting steal headlines, we must not forget the turmoil in the Western Hemisphere. Months of deadly anti-government protests have racked Venezuela under the increasingly autocratic and despotic government of Nicolas Maduro. Once a prosperous oil-rich country, Venezuela is beset by rampant crime, corruption, and staggering government dysfunction. Maduro has presided over an economic collapse that has caused extreme shortages of food and medicine. On the political front, he has ordered a new constituent assembly to be chosen on July 30th to rewrite the constitution. The effort is widely seen as a ploy by a deeply unpopular leader to consolidate power by disbanding the National Assembly, which is controlled by his opponents. Former Maduro loyalist Attorney General Luisa Ortega has denounced the move and has accused the president of betraying the legacy of Hugo Chavez. On Wednesday, July 5th, a mob stormed the opposition-dominated National Assembly with the apparent knowledge of government troops and carried out a startling attack on lawmakers and journalists. According to The Economist, in daily opposition protests since April, about 75 people have been killed in Venezuela, many shot by the National Guard or pro-regime gangs. And in June, President Donald Trump announced he was reversing crucial pieces of the Obama-era engagement with Cuba. Mr. Trump denounced the deal with Cuba as misguided and terrible. He is reinstating travel and commercial restrictions eased by the Obama administration in an attempt to obtain additional concessions from Havana. Critics say the measures might appease the dwindling hardline Cuban exile community in Miami, but may do little to persuade Havana to change course politically and may even hurt the very rank-and-file Cubans that began to benefit from the more open U.S. policy. Well, with us to discuss the deteriorating political and economic situation in Venezuela, as well as President Trump's revision of U.S.-Cuba policy, are two distinguished regional analysts. Eric Farnsworth is vice president of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society, and that's a Washington-based organization that's widely considered to be a leading voice on the Western Hemisphere. And Juan Carlos Hidalgo, he's a Latin American policy analyst at the Cato Institute, and that's a libertarian think tank based here in Washington. Eric Farnsworth joins us at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Carol. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you back. And for the first time, we're delighted to welcome Juan Carlos Hidalgo. He joins us by phone from his office at Cato Institute. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Let me begin with you here in the studio, Eric Farnsworth, to talk about the political and economic crisis in Venezuela. We've talked at these microphones before with you. What's the current situation?
Well, the current situation is, I think, deteriorating by the day. There is a deadline of sorts at the end of July, July 30th, which is the date by which the Maduro government has called for a constituent assembly to rewrite the constitution. And that has added some urgency to the opposition, which is trying to derail that particular exercise as being itself unconstitutional and certainly not supported by the majority of the Venezuelan people. And so you're seeing some increasing political maneuvering from both sides. Meanwhile, the street protests that began in late March have increased almost to a daily basis, not just in Caracas, where much of the news comes from, but across the country. And as you indicated in the introduction, the death toll is going up from the regime forces that are killing protesters. So it's a situation that has the potential to turn into a humanitarian crisis. Indeed, you're seeing thousands of Venezuelans crossing the border on a daily basis into Colombia, into Brazil, into the Caribbean as a means to try to feed their families, find medicine that's unavailable in Venezuela, and get away from the deteriorating security situation. So it's a pretty bad scenario right now. And from my perspective, it seems to be getting worse.
Let me turn to you, Juan Carlos Hidalgo, for your perspective on the current crisis, this political crisis, economic crisis in Venezuela, particularly as we run up to the so-called Constituent Assembly on July 30th. which many do see as a violation of the current constitution.
Indeed. Right now, I think Venezuela is facing the last battle for its democracy. If the clock is ticking, if the Constituent Assembly is successfully installed, it will have the power to remove the National Assembly. It will have the power to remove all other institutions, because the Constituent Assembly will have supra-constitutional powers. So once the Constituent Assembly is installed, it will have the power to remove judges, it will have the power to remove the Attorney General, who has been attorney the side of the regime lately. It will have the power to call off the regional elections for December, which are scheduled to take place in December. It will have the power to call off the next presidential election. So it will be basically the end of Venezuela's democracy. So, and I think that Venezuelans know this, and this is why they have taken the streets. Unfortunately, we don't see any cracks in the regime. Despite some defections by the most important figure being the Attorney General, we see that the armed forces are completely behind the regime. Of course, we don't know exactly the circumstances, but at least the rank and file of the armed forces continue to support Maduro. And as long as they are firmly behind the regime, it's going to be very difficult for the protesters to make a difference. Let's remember that when people talk about the possibility of a civil war in Venezuela, we have to keep in mind that only one side has the guns. The other side, being the people, are in the streets with rocks, with sticks, shields, but that's pretty much it. And it's a war of attrition. We are talking about 70 to over 100 people killed in the last 2 to 3 months of protests. And the question is if we will reach a point where people are simply going to fed up, realize that they're not making much of a difference and that the regime is moving ahead to consolidate communist socialist dictatorship.
Turning back to you here in the studio, Eric Farnsworth, a very dire, heartbreaking situation that you're both painting. We have a lopsided situation. We have the Maduro government with the arms and the power against the protesters. But what about potential cracks in the regime? Now, Juan Carlos Hidalgo says he doesn't see too many cracks in the regime or armed forces. But let's go back to the Attorney General, Luisa Ortega. She's a former Maduro loyalist. She has emerged as one of the most dangerous critics inside the Maduro government. What is the significance of her actions and behavior? And do you see it as a potential signal to others for defections that could possibly reverse this terrible trajectory downward?
Well, she's one individual, a powerful one to be sure, and her actions recently have been courageous. She has broken with the regime. She said publicly that she expects to be dismissed from her duties. But, you know, taking a broader look at this, you do have a situation in Venezuela where virtually every institution of the state is under the direct control now of the government, whether it's the Supreme Court, whether it's the entire judicial system, of course, the military and security forces, which we've talked about already, and many others, with one exception, and that's the national legislature. And the national legislature at the end of 2015 was democratically elected in a way that the opposition has a significant majority. And since that election, again at the end of 2015, the government has done everything it can systematically to undermine the legislature and to take away any authority that it might have. And so does one individual have the ability to reverse the course of the overall government? I would say most likely not, but it does open up political space for others to be able to say, well, the government has gone too far, this direction is wrong, it's clearly anti-democratic, and it's not according to the traditions of Venezuela, and we do need to change course. I think the key there is going to be from the international community. Will the international community rally behind individuals like the Attorney General and make this a cause celebre type of case, as has been done in other countries, to make her in some ways too important for the regime to try to really persecute or put on a show trial or something like this? It's not to say that they wouldn't, but to the extent that the international community is able to rally around opponents to the regime, it does mean that others may see the opportunity to make a lasting difference, even at some perhaps significant individual cost.
Quickly, before I turn back to Juan Carlos, do you see the so-called international community rallying opponents? I mean, what actions do we see in the United Nations or the Organization of American States?
Well, this is the key question, and that's why I'm not certain about this. I mean, we just had an example of the international community not rallying around the opposition in Venezuela. That was at the Organization of American States annual meeting recently in Cancun, Mexico. There was clearly a majority of regional countries that wanted to take and want to take a stronger stance to support democracy in Venezuela, but there was not a consensus that emerged according to the OAS's own rules. And so you do have an international community that does in some ways remain divided. So it's not certainly a guarantee, but meanwhile, the situation on the ground in Venezuela continues to deteriorate. So there's this natural conflict about an international community that may be moving toward a stronger stance on Venezuela. Meanwhile, the timeline is quickly running out before the end of this month. So they're on a different time track.
Turning back to you, Juan Carlos Hidalgo over at the Cato Institute, how optimistic or pessimistic are you that the international community, whether the United Nations or the OAS, which evidently failed in Cancun to condemn the government, will move fast enough before this constituent assembly can convene to reverse course in Venezuela?
I'm very pessimistic about the whole situation in Venezuela, but particularly about what to expect from the international community. We just had that General Assembly meeting of the OAS in Cancun, Mexico, where the foreign ministers of the region failed to pass a resolution, even calling for free elections and for the release of political prisoners. Something as simple as that could not be agreed on. So we don't have a consensus in the hemisphere about the need to restore the independence of institutions, releasing political prisoners, allowing humanitarian aid into the country. I don't think that there's anything we can expect from that organism in particular. But let's imagine that in Cancun, all the 34 foreign ministers had agreed, or 33, if we exclude Venezuela, had agreed on a resolution, a strong resolution, calling for elections, calling for the release of political prisoners, and denouncing the Maduro regime for its abuses. What would have happened? Nothing. Nothing. Venezuela already said that it's going to walk away from the OAS. It's going to withdraw from that organism. So even if the hemisphere engages in tougher pressure on the Maduro regime, I don't see how that's going to change the situation in the ground. Unfortunately, the resolution of this crisis is going to ultimately depend on Venezuelans in Venezuela. And as we talked before, the reality in the ground is very one-sided. One side has the guns. One side is firmly in power. And I don't see that changing anytime soon.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the America Society, and Juan Carlos Hidalgo, from whom you just heard. He's a Latin American policy analyst at the Cato Institute here in Washington. We're discussing the deteriorating political and economic situation in Venezuela, and soon we'll be talking about the significance of the reversal in U.S.-Cuba policy under President Donald Trump. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and like us on Facebook. And as always, we love to hear from you. Here's a shout out to Sokia Kon Kamai. He's a loyal listener from Cambodia. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page, Carol Castiel VOA. Well, back to you here in the studio, Eric Farnsworth. Before we turn to the U.S.-Cuba policy, more on Venezuela, because it really is, it seems that we're at a major inflection point. Something needs to be done. One more question, for example, to the armed forces. Do you see any change or potential defections among the members of the armed forces, or perhaps the community of Chavistas or the poor communities of Venezuela? To what extent could they, you know, turn the tide, perhaps together?
Well, there's always potential, and we have to remember the armed forces, or indeed the security forces, because they're not all part of the actual military, are not a unified organization, right? There are different branches of the military. Then there are paramilitaries called the colectivos, which are essentially motorcycle gangs which run around and enforce street discipline. There are other uniformed and ununiformed security forces in Venezuela as well. So it's not a homogeneous, you know, one institution or entity. But having said that, there are at least two reasons why it's been so difficult to anticipate that there would be a severe break in the discipline of the military and the security forces. For the simple reason that many of the leadership, and indeed down to a certain level, in these organizations are deeply implicated in corruption, illegal activities. Some have been accused of drug trafficking. And so there's a real incentive to remain loyal to the regime, which essentially protects them and allows them to continue to engage in these activities. And the second key reason is because the Venezuelans, in addition to some international outside support from Cuba and elsewhere, have really been able to keep tabs on the military in terms of understanding who is speaking out against the regime internally, trying to make sure that people remain loyal, gathering intelligence on individuals and units. Meanwhile, the leaders are rotated around the country on a regular basis so that nobody is able to build a significant base of support or loyalties among subgroups of individuals or units. So this is a very strategic approach that the government of Venezuela has taken now for a long while for the specific purpose of keeping the military and the security forces on its side. And so far, they've been successful, and we'll have to see if that continues.
Juan Carlos Hidalgo, I know you're rather pessimistic, but you have said the ultimate solution will be among the Venezuelan people. So the question to you, can the poor, the core of Chavistas, perhaps turn the tide? What about the armed forces? Will they turn on Maduro, or are they too complicit, as Eric Farnsworth suggested?
I totally agree with Eric. Those two reasons are why it's very difficult to expect the military to turn on the regime. First of all, the rank and file of the armed forces is deeply involved in criminal activities, from drug trafficking to, you know, the distribution of food, which is a very profitable business, and so on. Not only are they making lots of money out of this, but the alternative for these guys, if they were to be out of power, is probably going to jail or being extradited to the United States. It's not retiring in a farm, you know, with a government pension. The alternative is pretty dire. So they have a strong incentive to back the regime up to the last consequences. So this is the rank and file. And let's remember that Venezuela has over 2,000 generals, more than the United States. What about the troops? Well, as Eric mentioned, the fact that the Cuban secret services are deeply ingrained into the Venezuelan armed forces means that they are spying possible defectors. And it's very difficult for an individual, let's say a lieutenant or sergeant, to organize the kind of military uprising that will be needed to topple the regime. So when it comes to the armed forces, I honestly believe that we're in a checkmate position. I don't think that they have the incentives to turn on the regime. Just the opposite. They're going to stick to it. About the poor, well, I think that the support for the government among the poorest Venezuelan has been deeply eroding. And again, the polls indicate that over 70 to 80% of Venezuelans are against the Maduro regime. The poor are suffering more than anyone else from the scarcity of food, the shortage of medicines, and so on. Unfortunately, I believe that most of the poor people are too busy surviving in Venezuela, and they don't have the time to go out into the streets. If you look at the protests, most of the protesters are middle-class people, while the poor are still trying to live by in the slums, trying to get food, trying to get the medicine. There hasn't been that combination of forces between the middle-class Venezuelans and the poorest Venezuelans to take to the street.
Well, gentlemen, we'll be following this in the coming weeks in the run-up to the Constituent Assembly. Let's hope that something can forestall this disaster. Let's move on as we close to U.S.-Cuba policy. Eric Farnsworth, what President Trump did was not a wholesale reversal of President Obama's policy of opening. We still have diplomatic relations, but it does send a signal to the Cuban people. The United States is pulling back. What's your take on this? Does it help or hurt ordinary Cubans? Will it exact more concessions from Havana, as President Trump suggested it might?
Well, this is something that the president promised to do on the campaign trail, and indeed he has done that with some support from leading members of Congress, particularly the U.S. Senate. And as you say, it takes some steps. It did not take other steps, and so it was not a wholesale reversal, but rather a recalibration, perhaps. And the short answer is we don't know, because much of this is going to depend on the regulations that are actually written to implement the new policy, and that's going to be perhaps difficult to do absent a full government that's actually in place. And what I mean by that is there are a number of senior officials, particularly at the State Department and other agencies with jurisdiction over these issues, who have not yet been nominated or confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And so these are just simple bureaucratic realities of getting people in place to do the work that's necessary to implement the policy shift. So I guess I would say the jury is still out, still unclear.
What's your take, Juan Carlos Hidalgo, on this semi-reversal of policy? Is it more politics and a way to sort of appease some of the hardline community in Miami and some of the senators like Marco Rubio, who is very in favor of this partial reversal? Or do you think, you know, it has some potential to move Havana in a different direction politically?
It was more symbolic. It was all about politics. I don't think this is going to move Cuba an inch. It didn't move Cuba an inch for over 50 years of failed policy when the U.S. tried to isolate Cuba with the embargo and the travel ban. I agree with Eric that the devil is in the details. We have to look at what kind of regulations are going to be in place, particularly when it comes to preventing Americans from doing tourism in the island. Let's remember that the travel ban is still in the books, but the Obama administration basically dismantled it by relaxing the regulations and telling people, well, as long as you go for educational purposes to the island, you're allowed to travel. And we're not going to request you to prove when you come back that you were doing educational activities while you were visiting Cuba. Now the Trump administration says you're not allowed to go for tourism anymore. If you go, you have to go for the categories that are in the books, which includes religious purposes and historical and educational and so on. And the question is how the administration pretends to enforce this, because still you have over dozens of flights daily to the island. You have cruises going to the island. So you will require a lot of manpower at the airports and the ports of the United States to enforce that people going to the island actually were engaging in other sort of activities and not in tourism. But if the administration were to actually prevent Americans from going to Cuba for tourism purposes, that's going to hurt mostly Cubans. Let's remember that U.S. tourism is very democratic, quote-unquote, because U.S. tourists tend to stay mostly with Cubans in the private houses, in Airbnbs and so on. Whereas Canadians and Europeans, when they visit Cuba, they tend to stay at resorts, which are mostly government-owned. So the money that from European and Canadian tourism mostly goes to the government coffers, whereas the money from U.S. tourism mostly goes to the private common Cubans. And if, for some reason, these new regulations are going to shrink the number of U.S. tourists going to the island, that's going to hurt them, the Cuban people. That's not going to hurt the regime.
One last question back to you here in the studio, Eric Farnsworth. Again, what Juan Carlos Hidalgo is saying is what many critics of this current partial reversal are saying. They fear that if anybody wants Cuba to actually change and reform, that this policy could actually do the opposite of that. It doesn't really help ordinary Cubans who were benefiting, you know, businesses, and it won't really affect the government, which is not planning to change its political outlook anytime soon, whether we engage or not engage.
I think the Castro regime has proven pretty resilient over the years to changes from the United States, changes to the international community, changes to the former Soviet Union, now changes to Venezuela. It has its own dynamic on the island and led by the government. So that's certainly one interpretation.
And the last word to you, Juan Carlos Hidalgo, on Cuba and where you think this is going.
Well, let's remember that this is a Stalinist dictatorship that has been in place for nearly 60 years. So we cannot expect that they're going to become more democratic overnight. We cannot criticize the Obama policy. It's been in place basically for 2 years or less, where we can compare the failure of the previous efforts to isolate the island for over 50 years, and it didn't move the Havana regime an inch. I think that, again, just as we were talking in Venezuela, change in Cuba is going to ultimately depend on Cubans. But I think it's easier in the long run to bring about change in Cuba if Americans engage with Cubans in the island, whereas that is doing trade with them, doing commerce, by traveling there, exchanging ideas, exchanging goods. I think that's, in the long run, the best policy to try to bring about change in Cuba. If you isolate Cubans and you prevent Americans from traveling to the island, you prevent Americans from engaging in trade, that's only going to help the regime by impoverishing the Cuban people and also by providing the regime with an excuse for the failures of its economic policy. I remember for over 50 years that's been the official line in Cuba, that we are poor, that the island is miserable because of the blockade, that's the way they call it. Well, if you engage Cuba, that's going to be finally off the table, and the Cuban regime will have to explain why they continue to be miserable.
And interestingly, many Republican lawmakers who normally would side with Mr. Trump on other issues are in favor of greater engagement. So we will see how this tug of war plays out in the days ahead. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Eric Farnsworth, he's Vice President of the American Society and the Council of the Americas, and Juan Carlos Hidalgo, Latin American Policy Analyst at the Cato Institute. Gentlemen, thank you. Gracias for your keen insights.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.